Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
9/11 would become a date to remember.
The plane disappeared.
What?
The World Trade.
Who are you talking to?
Oh, God.
It was two realizations, right? The immediate death toll and then the fact that this was an attack on America.
During a crisis, it's really important to set a tone and not to panic.
You don't want a mosque in Murfreesboro?
No.
Why is that?
Because that's where they gather to take over America.
I think the people who are protesting the mosque are scared. I think they live in fear.
Muslim Americans are the model citizens on paper. And yet, many of them have said that they've spent the past 10 years telling people who they're not, rather than telling people who they are.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright. This weekend marked the 20th anniversary of 9/11, and that has, of course, prompted lots of reflection on how those attacks changed the world. Tonight, though, we're going to reflect on how the response to those attacks changed many of us, and how it changed the way some people in the United States even think about their own identities. We're going to take your calls on that question later in the show, but first, I'm joined by someone who has spent much of his adult life reflecting on identity and religion in the United States, and on what it means to be Muslim in a post-9/11 America. Ayman Ismail is a writer at Slate and was host of the magazine's video series, Who's Afraid of Ayman Ismail?, in which he traveled the country meeting anti-Muslim activists and lawmakers, among other people. He grew up in northern New Jersey, just outside of Manhattan, and was 11 years old on the morning of 9/11. Ayman, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
So it is standard practice in New York, as you know, to ask people where they were and what they were doing on 9/11. Your own story is actually quite harrowing, as I hear it. You were in school at a private Muslim school. Tell us about what happened for you that morning.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I'm still feeling the emotions from just passing 9/11. I mean, I missed the Twin Towers, and I used to look to the Twin Towers in New Jersey where I was to know which way was east and where my dad worked. He used to work as a driver in that area. And so in the mornings, he would drop us off on his way to work. And the school that I was going to was called El Ghazali High School, and it was right in Teaneck, New Jersey, so really just right across the water. So when it happened, none of us knew. We were all sitting in class. We had heard on the intercom that we were going to have an emergency assembly in like the main prayer hall slash cafeteria slash gymnasium, whatever. And so we go and we meet with the principal, and the principal says, look, we got to evacuate you guys. He doesn't tell us why. He just tells us to get in a single line and go out the back door and onto buses that were waiting for us. We had no idea why. It wasn't until we were on the buses leaving the premises that I saw that a small crowd had gathered right outside of the school. And they were throwing stones and they were chanting. And it happened so quick, we were out of there. And it wasn't until we were on the highway when we were stuck in traffic when I turned around and I saw the black cloud.
Yeah. And I mean, here we are there's an attack happening, and here you are, an 11-year-old also being attacked. What about your dad? He's a driver in the city. What happened to him that day?
Yeah, so all I know about my dad is that he drives in lower Manhattan and that he takes people to the World Trade Center all the time. And when we were driving together in the car in New Jersey, he would point to those towers and say, hey, look, that's where I work. So those towers meant a lot to me. That's how I I knew where my dad was when I would miss him. And that, when I saw the black cloud and I knew exactly where it was coming from and what had just happened, all I can think of was, is my dad okay? Is my dad okay? Will I ever see my dad again? You know, when we got evacuated, I was able to get home safely, thank God. My siblings were all there. They'd all left their schools too. And my mom was trying to comfort us because we all were so worried sick about our dad. And there was no way to get in touch with him. This is way before iPhones, obviously. Yeah. But we were watching TV. We were watching the live broadcast. I think we were watching Diane Sawyer's Ground Zero coverage as it was unfolding. And there was this moment when the tower suddenly collapsed and a cloud of debris, this white fog, was turning corners really fast and just swallowing whole streets with people on them. And we're just glued to the screen looking for our dad. We were just praying that we would catch a glimpse of him so that we'd know that he was alive. It wasn't until the next day that he came home, and he was covered in a little bit of dust, and he told us that he had walked home from New York, and all he wanted to do was get to bed, and that was that.
Man, there's so many people with stories like that from that day. It's just hard to imagine. And walked home all the way to Northern New Jersey, you know? You had to get back.
Yeah, yeah. And we knew people who were in a similar situation where their dads also worked in that area. And I know at least two people whose dads never came home that night. So I say it with a huge amount of gratitude that we were able to see him after that.
Indeed.
But that night was terror.
Why you were in a private Muslim school. Why'd your parents have you in that school in the first place? Why did they want you to have that education?
Yeah. So it was really important for them as Egyptian immigrants that they raised kids who both spoke Arabic and understood their religion, Islam, the one that we were being raised on. They were so afraid of losing their kids to just the melting pot. You know, on one hand, they were excited to be here and to participate in the American dream. On the other hand, they still wanted their kids to have that same connection and that same love for God. So they spent money they didn't even have, by the way. You know, my dad's a driver. We're pretty humble income, sending all four of their kids, actually, to private school so that we can learn Arabic and take a class about Islam in the same way that we would take a class about math and science. Right. And, you know, at the time, I'm kind of lamenting it. I'm not really that excited about having to go to a private school where we had wore uniforms. And I had friends from the local park, and I knew how much fun they were having at the public school. So I was kind of annoyed. I was like, I want to go to that school. Like, it's next door. It's where all my friends go. But now that I'm older, I'm so thankful that they made that sacrifice so that we can speak Arabic. Because with Islam, they spent so much time and so much effort during the 7th century and the 8th century to preserve the oral tradition of the Quran. You know, it wasn't a book at the time. Mm-hmm. But they spent so much time trying to perfect it so that every generation that followed got the exact same message, totally clean of, you know, a human influence. Nobody could change it if you can speak Arabic and you can understand it yourself. So it was really important for them that we had a direct connection to the Holy Book. Yeah. And that's why we went to that school.
But then, you know, you talk about the knowing that the kids in the park were having fun at the public school. You did move to that public school after 9/11 in Newark. And honestly, part of why I'm starting out with your story here is because part of what's most interesting to me about it is that despite all that your family faced, 9/11 didn't change you personally that much, at least as a kid, right? I mean, how did the kids in the public school when you got there react to you?
Yeah, so my parents gave me the choice. They said, what do you want to do? Do you want to wait and stay out of school and see whether or not the private school reopens? Because after the protests and there were several bomb threats that were made towards the school, they just decided that it was better off not to invite the kids back in. So my parents gave me the choice.
It'd be hard for them, you know, for your parents,
yeah.
I imagine.
Yeah, I don't think they got their tuition money back either, but that's besides the point. They basically said, hey, Eamon, what do you want to do? Do you want to go to the public school and maybe we can do like some Sunday classes because we know you're not in a place yet where you are perfect in Arabic? My other siblings were. I'm the youngest. So they thought that those kids were fine. They had already been pulled out of the private school and put in the public school. But in my case, they were thinking he might not be ready. So they gave me the choice. And I chose the public school because I'm a kid at this point, right? I want to go to where all my friends were going. And I want to be able to walk to school and have that freedom to walk back. I don't have to need to get a ride to a totally different city. And so I craved that independence. But I didn't even think of it that till that first day when I was enrolled in the new school, that it was just days after this horrific terrorist attack. And they were, in many cases, going to meet a Muslim for the first time. Yeah. And then all the paranoia set in. You know, at this point, we had already faced a lot of Islamophobia. We were aware of all of the complaints, and we knew people who were getting punched in the face in the street and people having things thrown at them. My mother wore a headscarf, and so it was unavoidable when we go to the groceries together. I'd see the way people looked at her and the way they treated her. And one occasion, one kid made his hand into a gun and went pow, 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 you know? I was aware that life had just changed for Muslims forever. But at the same time, I started to embody it. You know, I was worried about how people would treat me, how people would think of me, especially as this new kid. But I guess it's a blessing that I was going to a public school in a very, very diverse area, and that in this corner of America, everybody was from somewhere. So when people saw me, first, well, they thought I was Dominican or Brazilian, which is pretty funny. That gave me a huge relief. But on the other hand,
New York life, right? Because everybody's from somewhere, and it's always like, wait, who are you?
It's a blessing. And at the same time, when I told them I was Arabic and that my family came from Egypt, one of the first reactions I had was, oh, like Aladdin. And I was like, oh, thank God. That's the other stereotype. Thank God. But no, I don't think it changed me in the sense where I became like a whole new person. I was still just trying to make the most of life with the freedoms that I had, right? I was still excited about going to school and excited about making new friends. But at the same time, I was thrust into this new state of being where I needed to not only navigate the, you know, puberty and learning to talk to girls and having crushes on people. I was navigating all of that through a context now where when I said that I was Muslim, people would assign to me a whole identity. Mm-hmm. They would almost wonder if I deviated from that predestined identity, what was wrong with me? Why wasn't I like the Muslims that they had learned about on CNN or on ABC? What was different about me? Not that I was just an individual with their own character and their own desires. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And so, but how did you then carry that? How did you respond to that?
I embraced it, you know? And I think a lot of Muslims can relate to this, but I almost felt a certain amount of responsibility towards my community to argue on our behalf. So when we're on the playground and kids are making jokes and, you know, one kid, it might have been serious. I don't know. I like to think that he was being funny. He was asking me, because he had just seen my mom pick me up from school, asking me, what does she keep under there? Why is she wearing a scarf over her head? What's under that scarf? And I joked. I was like, well, you know, we're from the desert, so it gets really hot. We need to carry air conditioners. So they carry air conditioners under there. You know, so it was like a really, like I almost made fun of them for being so silly in the things that they would believe. Mm-hmm. So I kind of made fun of it. And also I kind of had a way of navigating these spaces where people trusted me to kind of set the course right.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the point in your adult life when it really did start to change for you. I'm talking with Slate writer Ayman Ismail, and we'll be right back.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
What if millions of Black Americans had been compensated for slavery? Join me, Trymaine Lee, as I explore the untold story of one of the only Black Americans who ever was. I talk to his descendants and discuss how reparations forever changed their family's trajectory and imagine a reality where reparations are paid to the rest of Black America. Into America presents Uncounted Millions, The Power of Reparations, a Black History Month series. New episodes drop Thursdays. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. I'm Kai Wright, and I am with Ayman Ismail, a writer for Slate Magazine, who was also host of the 2018 video series, Who's Afraid of Ayman Ismail, in which he traveled the country meeting, among other people, anti-Muslim activists and lawmakers. And Ayman, before the break, I mentioned that I know that it was really once you got to be an adult, once you got a little older, that you began to actually feel more like something had shifted for you as a Muslim man. What brought that about?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that a lot of people can relate to. The police in any urban area are in a way looking for crime and looking for crime before it happens. And so as a little kid, you tend to be able to get away with a lot, right? We were jumping turnstiles to get from New Jersey to New York all the time just to have fun. We would also just be walking around in huge groups, again, like just having fun. But then you start to notice a change in the way that you're perceived when you hit a certain age and you start, maybe you have some facial hair, maybe your pants are getting baggier or something, where now all of a sudden, the police who might have let you slide are now asking you to stop so they can search your pockets and search your book bag. And for me, I always had like a big beard, mostly because I didn't know how to groom it pretty well. It was just like a big, like chunky beard that I always had. And so I think a lot of law enforcement at the time saw that as license to kind of investigate me further. And I had a lot of friends from like West Africa. I had a lot of friends from Latin America. And so I would see this not only in my personal experience as a Muslim American, but I saw this in lots of people's experiences, right? I wasn't able to get very far in a certain neighborhood in a car without getting pulled over and searched if the person driving the car looked a certain way. And that's just the reality that we learned to navigate. And we had to figure that out quickly because we don't necessarily know that we're changing, right? It kind of happens slowly for us. But it's really fast when it hits you. And so it happened several times where I would go to on the subway and I would be pulled aside for a random search. Or if something were to happen, like they would stop me and ask to see my ID just to make sure that I'm not the person that they're looking for. On several occasions, I had cops follow me from one stop to the next when I'm just on my way to work or on my way to lunch break or something. But it didn't really like hit hard until I think the AP did this investigation and the ACLU sued the NYPD to declassify this massive spying program and mapping program where they instructed their officers to wear plain clothes and go into places where they knew Muslims frequented, whether that's like restaurants or prayer halls or even student groups, to take notes and tell their employers so that they can survey who these Muslims are. And the idea behind that was, well, we were attacked by Muslims, right, on 9/11. And the only way to prevent another 9/11 is to keep a tab on these Muslims. And so I really felt like a gravitational weight by just even passing by a cop because I could feel their eyes on me.
And did that show up in your social circle? I mean, did you start seeing that?
Of course, yeah. I mean, there was on one occasion where it really got difficult, man. I was a photographer. I might have even forgot that I was a Muslim kid to like put it plainly. I just saw myself as a photographer, always looking for like the next best shot, as a journalist trying to get the story that other people might miss. And there was this moment that New York City was having where people were climbing bridges and going in tunnels to basically take pictures. It was like urban exploring is what it was called. And so I had learned about this one kid who was really great at climbing bridges. And so I asked him, can I shadow you for a night so I can write this story? And he was cool. So I said, let's do it. And so I go and I do the story, and it felt amazing. And the New York Times linked to it. And it was like an event, you know, it brought a lot of traffic to the magazine that I was working at the time. It felt really good. Mm-hmm. And then months later, this happened, I think, in November in like 2013. It wasn't until April of 2014 where I'm out on a different assignment. And my roommate calls me in a panic saying, yo, Eamon, there's like four detectives here. What do I tell them? I'm like, well, I don't know. Just tell them to leave if they don't have a warrant. And they said, okay. And they left a card, and I gave it to the lawyer at the magazine that I was working at. I was like, I don't know what to make of this. He calls me after he talks to them, and he says, look, there's no way around it. They want you to turn yourself in. I'm like, okay, this sounds serious. Let me not let this escalate. I'll be the good person and turn myself in. It was for trespassing because I had climbed the bridge for that story. Now, yeah, trespassing is a misdemeanor, and it was my first time ever getting arrested for anything. So it was my first time offense. Typically, if the law was being applied for this kind of thing, they would give you a ticket had they even caught you in the act, and they would give you a summons, and you would have to show up to court whenever that would happen. But in this case, they sent detectives to my house, and it almost felt like they had found a reason to go after this Muslim kid. And the only reason I feel confident saying that is because the questions they asked me when I was in custody weren't about the bridges, and it wasn't about the right story or even the person that I was doing the story on. It was, how Muslim are you? How often do you pray? Which mosque do you pray at? Do you know such and such activist with a Muslim name? And one even so bluntly said, if you knew about a terrorist attack, would you be comfortable letting us know? And my response was, well, of course I would. I live in this city. When 9/11 happened, that was an attack on all of us. How could you not see us as on the same team against those terrorists? It was dumbfounding. It turns out it didn't matter what I said to them, because when it was my turn to see a judge after 36 hours of sitting in the Tombs, which is this underground bunker underneath the central bookings, where they keep people while they wait to see a judge. They held me for the maximum amount of time, 36 hours. And then when I did see a judge, the judge very quickly glanced at my file, glanced at me. And then what he said blew my mind. He said, you know, if you do something like this again, we're going to have to look into deporting you. And I'm like, oh my God, this guy thinks I'm not even from here.
And you're like, I grew up right here.
I was born one and a half miles away from where that jail was, in Jersey City, on a cliff facing the New York City skyline. Like, I'm as American as they get, man. Come on. Mm-hmm. And it was so heartbreaking, because all I can feel in that moment was, how could I have let myself become so naive that I would be seen as anything in this situation, anything other than just a Muslim kid who's a potential terrorist? And if I'm not a terrorist, maybe I can be useful in catching the next one. Like, we're all just in like some big group chat talking about blowing stuff up. Like, it's insane. It was heartbreaking in so many ways. And, you know, anybody in New York who's been involved with the law in that way knows that once they have your name and once they have a reason to stop you, they will. Yeah. And so that became the beginning of a series of escalating harassments, where they would slap cuffs on me just for checking my ID and seeing the name come up. And, you know, it was bad.
Listeners, I do want to get you in the conversation too. It does not have to have been as dramatic of a story as Eamon has faced, but a lot of people in this city have faced similar things. Did 9/11, if anything happened in the aftermath of 9/11 that changed the way you think about your identity in the U.S., it could be religious, it could be ethnic, it could be otherwise. 646-435-7280. That's 646-435-7280. We got a voice memo emailed to us before the show from Sheila in Brooklyn. Here's what she had to say.
I'm Iranian and American. I was born here, but my parents emigrated from Iran. It did affect my identity, my sense of who I was, for a long time. I couldn't relate to the jingoism. I think I felt less American for a really long time. I wasn't raised religious. But I started to feel really protective of Muslims in America and Muslims abroad. And it made me question whether I wanted to have children. And if I did have them, would I raise them here? I think in the last 10 years, what's helped me feel more American again is really identifying with all the more recent immigrant populations in this country and realizing that, you know, we all belong here and maybe we have to fight for that.
So that was Sheila in Brooklyn. David in Midtown, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. Well, I'm a former prosecutor for 10 years. And I remember the day where, you know, you're literally walking over the ashes in the street from everyone who died. And I remembered having to pick up my kids, who were very, very young at the time, and try to explain to them what happened and what happened within a building that they had visited, the school trips, et cetera. And also, I remember going to a religious service that night, a synagogue, that was overflowing, more people than I'd ever seen, even on the highest holidays. And the only messages I heard, I didn't hear of messages of vengeance. I didn't hear messages of warnings of bad things to come, but messages of hope and prayer and the need to be together. And I will tell you, the synagogue we attended is a very, very open one, non-denominational. And there were people who just came in the neighborhood from all walks of life. They weren't necessarily Jewish. And I will just say that hopefully over 20 years, we can learn a lot about ourselves. We can learn a lot about the threats abroad. We can learn a lot about how to treat each other. And for the 20th anniversary, it's a little bit off topic, but one of the things that I decided to do was to drive down to Charlottesville and revisit the places where the demonstrations and the encounters had occurred and to try to understand that as well. Yeah. So if I were to give a message of 20 years past, it's we all have to continue to think and to understand what our responsibility is to each other.
Thank you, David. I'm gonna stop you there. And wow. Eamon, I also want to play, I put this question to one of our colleagues here at WNYC earlier today, and I want to play you what he said. Joseph Jedian, he's a reporter in our race and justice unit who's been covering the 9/11 anniversary and is actually out reporting right now, so he can't join us live. But he's got a great piece up on Gothamist about exactly the NYPD spying on Muslim communities that you were talking about. So folks should check it out. But he was 9 years old in 2001, and he lived in Los Angeles. And his mom and dad are immigrants, Egyptian and Palestinian, respectively. And they're devout Christians, not Muslims. Yet what happened to them in the aftermath really changed things for Joseph as a child. Here's what he told me earlier today.
You know, at that point in my life, I had not thought of myself as different. I had thought of myself as 9 year old. I liked to play sports. I had a pen pal in New York and we would talk. You know, my dad is and always was a super patriotic American. The thing about us is we spoke Arabic and we spoke Arabic at home. I lived in a pretty diverse area. We were speaking Arabic with, you know, in our neighborhoods, somewhat with our cousins, with our families. And I was under the impression growing up that everyone spoke Arabic. I thought everyone at that time was speaking Arabic. You know, that was just my worldview. Now, 9/11 happened and we're freaking out. And we had just moved into this new neighborhood. And a couple weeks in, we had some neighbors, like a group of neighbors, maybe seven, eight neighbors come to our door and they told us, you got to hang an American flag in the front of your house. We want you to hang an American flag so you show us what side you're on. And, wow. You know, I didn't really understand why they would say that to us, why they would single us out. I had never really thought of my identity at that point, really. Now, my dad was stateless, right? So his first passport was an American passport. So he considers himself patriotic. You know, this is the country that gave him a citizenship. His whole life, he didn't have one. Now, all of a sudden, we're being questioned about our Americanness. What did we end up doing? My dad bought the biggest American flag he could find. He hung it up right in the front. that's when I started to realize that I was different. I started to question, you know, I was 9 years old. I wasn't really thinking about it before, but from there, I started catching these little things, you know, people staring at us on the bus, my mom speaking Arabic on the phone, and then when someone's close by, she'll whisper or she'll stop talking, you know, and it just escalated more and more into our adulthood, really.
I mean, we've got about, you know, a minute here, but I wanted to play that because of the point about his parents and their patriotism. And I gather, how do you think this has shifted the way that Muslim Americans think about themselves politically?
Wow. So both David and Joseph both have incredibly powerful stories, and I'm just letting them absorb right now. But I think politically speaking, strictly, I think it gave Muslims the courage to speak for themselves in a very big way. And I think a lot of that came from the aftermath, specifically in how Muslims were talked about in media. A lot of times people were having programming about who these Muslims were without actually inviting Muslims on. Mm-hmm. And so you had these pundits kind of arguing over what they've heard about Islam and really scaring everybody, right? Muslims included. Mm-hmm. And so I think in the long run, 20 years later, it's just undeniable that Muslims have come to the occasion and are starting to speak for themselves in a very loud and unavoidable way. I mean, we have representation in Congress like we've never seen. We have TV shows that are, you know, on one hand, yeah, they are about Islam, but they are hilarious and we're just killing it. We're in sports, we're in movies, we're in TV, we're here. And I think in a lot of ways that is proof that the American experience and the American experiment is success.
Ayman Ismail is a writer for Slate and host of the series Who's Afraid of Ayman Ismail? Up next, a conversation with the creators of the hit Broadway show Come From Away about a true 9/11 story.
Hey everyone, this is Kusha. I'm a producer on the show. For the past few weeks, I've been asking you to send us a message about where else you spend time online when you're not listening to the United States of Anxiety. Quick shout out to one listener, Brandon from Texas and going to school at Georgetown. He sent a thoughtful message and I want to read you some highlights. Brandon says, when I'm not listening to this podcast, I'm usually on either YouTube or TikTok. In the past, I've listened to some podcasts on YouTube. TikTok's 3-minute limitation doesn't really allow for great listening, but I'm loving the recent intersection between podcasts and TikTok. Love the GIF. Thanks, Brandon. I'm happy you like the GIF we sent you. We appreciate you listening and writing. And hey, that applies to all the rest of you listening too. So if you agree with Brandon and you like YouTube and TikTok, or you spend time other places, or hey, you just want to find out what GIF we sent him, send us an email or a voice message. The address is anxiety@wnyc.org. All right. Thanks again. Talk to you soon.
Welcome back. I'm Kai Wright. There are many lasting scars from 9/11, but there are actually some inspiring memories too. One of them is the story of what happened that morning and over the next several days in Gander, Newfoundland, in Canada. If you're a Broadway fan like myself, then you know this story probably. It's been dramatized in the Tony Award-winning musical Come From Away. And the show's creators collaborated with Apple TV Plus to release a film version of it this weekend in conjunction with the 20th anniversary of 9/11. The show tells the remarkable and true story of about 7,000 passengers who were on their way to different parts of the United States on the morning of September 11th. All of their flights, 38 large planes, were diverted to this tiny, secluded town and parked there for days. The show depicts how the town welcomed those lost travelers.
Tuesday, September 11th, 2001. Any available community buildings will be converted into shelters. With thousands of passengers arriving at any minute, the town is asking for help with, well, anything you can do.
It arrived on Broadway in early 2017, a story about simple kindness. And it struck a chord. It ran until the pandemic shut all of Broadway down, but it will be back on the stage later this month. A lot of people on our team love this show. So this week, we connected with its creators, a married writing team, Irene Sankoff and David Hine. We talked about how art can help us process tragedy and conflict. Irene and David, thank you so much for joining us.
Our pleasure.
It's great to be here.
So you guys have written, as many people have said, just an ode to decency, which landed on Broadway at a time when it felt like decency was a very rare thing. Many people have commented on that timing that, you know, setting 9/11 aside entirely, audiences were in deep need of a story about people treating each other well. And obviously you wrote it way before that, but I wonder, you know, what motivated that focus on decency? Was it prescience about the times we were going to be living in?
I think it was awe, honestly, you know, just being in Gander on the 10th anniversary and talking with people who returned 10 years later to thank people for what they'd done before, hearing all of the stories. I mean, each one was more memorable than the last. And we are so used to seeing, even then, we were so used to seeing horrible things on our TV screens that just being like, whoa, like this is something completely different in that you're listening to this story and, you know, the other shoe never drops.
I read once where Toni Morrison talked about creating tension through acts of cooperation as opposed to through acts of conflict. And I thought about that a lot watching the show.
Yeah, exactly. People have often said that there isn't really an antagonist in our show. And the antagonist really is the one that we all had, which was, you know, a horrible tragedy that so many people were dealing with. And the action of the show, the action of the story that we heard was how people overcame it and how they overcame it together. That's the story that we wanted to tell.
So it's also been widely noted that this is a story in which the chorus is the hero. So I wonder about that too, this sort of decentering of the heroic leader and why that was how you wanted to process what happened on 9/11.
I think although there were many leaders, obviously, a lot of the leaders also knew, and this is another thing about great leadership, a lot of the leaders knew when to be like, and you're best at that, so you've got that under control. You know what I mean? So like there wasn't one person who was like, I've got this all. It was just everybody being like, okay, I got this and they've got that and they'll tell me if they need anything. And I think it's important.
Yeah. I love that there's something democratizing about doing small acts, random acts of kindness towards people. And it feels small to just do one of them or to just help one person. But the fact is, the story of Gander, the story of Newfoundland helping in 9/11 is a story about thousands and thousands of small acts of kindness that all together came together to form this incredible outpouring of support for people. And so, you know, it feels often like, you know, it's a drop in the bucket to do this one small thing. But if you have faith that everyone else is working together and that you're working together as part of a community, it turns into something much larger. And so I think that was important for us to reflect in the show, is that every single person out there was doing something. Even the people on the planes, they had every right to be scared and angry and confused and mad. And instead, they worked with the people there. They were gentle with each other. They were patient and grateful. And it actually takes work to accept generosity sometimes when you're scared and angry. It was a whole community working together, and it's become a model for us and something good for us to remember that we actually can do that in times of darkness.
But I mean, now, of course, it also, who you are determines whether you find the chorus and the collective comforting or terrifying. And in reality, the chorus in America turned quite dark in the years after 9/11. And the show, we first see a sign of that with the Egyptian man.
Citizenship.
American.
Egyptian.
Who is greeted by security on the island quite differently from everybody else.
Family.
The business, just business.
Destination.
L.A.
Dallas. Then Washington, D.C.
Thank you.
Could you come with me, sir?
How did you want people to think about that tension in this show between the sort of the good and the evil of the chorus, as it were, in our society?
You know, it's funny. We were looking through emails from our time in New York at the time, and what I remember in New York at the time was the fact that we could overcome any differences. You could talk to anyone because everyone was going through the same thing together. So you could reach out to someone just on the street and say, how are you doing? Are you okay? And that's what I remember is that kindness. But I also remember meeting a man who worked at Windows on the World and who, you know, who lost a lot of his staff that day. And he was quite angry and Islamophobic in the time afterwards. And we got into an argument. And so there was this really, this dichotomy of the ability to reach out to anyone and to have conversations. And at the same time, the other side of the coin is this anger and this divisiveness in response to that. And so when we were writing the show, we felt like it was important to show that this was actually the beginning of Islamophobia. There was a lot of fear and concern about strangers at the time. And we now have kids with Muslim parents who come to see the show and they're like, oh, that's when it all changed. That's why my parents have been afraid. That's why. So it was important to sort of illustrate that that was part of it. And at the same time to have Ali, the character of Ali, make the choice at the end that he was going to remember the kindness that he was shown and that that was important for him. And that was how he was going to teach his daughter.
It's interesting. You mentioned the audience members who, you know, young people who come with their parents and say, oh, that's the time this turned. And I wonder about other stories like that you've heard from audience members. If there are particular songs or moments in the show that helped people process their own experience with 9/11.
I think as people are watching the show, they start their own tape of their memory in their head. And our show doesn't bombard the audience with traumatic or jarring images. It relies on text and it relies on emotion and it relies on music. And the music kind of guides you and it kind of keeps you safe, you know, because like, you know, just as soon as things start to get really, really kind of tense or dark, you know, it brings you back up again. And I think a lot of people respond to the prayer when it's... make me a channel of your peace, and then there's other prayers layered in. And I think looking at everyone working together to pray as they did at that time in the library in the town of Gander is very inspiring. And we've got that Covers from Away album coming out where we've got, once again, that same prayer. This time we reached out to an Indigenous artist from Newfoundland to layer in a prayer and work with the elders to create something, because that seems very current right now up in Canada. Yeah. It is very current. It doesn't seem that way. It is. It always has been very current. Just finally we're waking up.
Yeah. I mean, this is an example. That song is an example of the way the show just deals with diversity in interesting ways that to be honest, challenge me also. You know, I confess to hating the word diversity. It so often evokes a kind of tolerance that doesn't ask anything of people, doesn't force you to actually think about power and privilege and how it's doled out. But then I think about it, you know, when I watch this show, I think about it in these much smaller ways. And that's when it gets really powerful. The moment in the show that gets me start crying is, I think the song is Darkness and Trees.
Ladies and gentlemen.
And people are trying to figure out how to communicate despite speaking different languages and having totally different social context. And there's the family holding a Bible on the bus that don't speak English, and they see these people in uniform in the context of soldiers shuffling you on and off buses is terrifying in their context, you know, and the bus driver sees their Bible, knows that they don't speak English, they can't communicate, and he finds a Bible verse, Philippians 4:6, to communicate through, be anxious for nothing.
And look, Philippians 4:6, be anxious for nothing. And that's how we started speaking the same language.
And I guess, you know, that's a long way for me to ask. I wonder about the ways in which we're searching for a common language, particularly around diversity and story, like the detail and smallness of story as a way to provide it for us now.
You know, we heard many stories about a grandmother who didn't speak English, and when... the granddaughter explained to her on the bus, oh, they're taking us to a camp. you know, thinking, you know, like, oh, camp for me is when I went away to summer camp and it was fine. So this is where we're going. But the grandmother bursts into tears because she's thinking, oh, that's where I lost my family, was in a Holocaust camp. Mm. So there were so many of these tiny details. And yes, we did try to get in as many of them as possible to show like how we have to kind of look past like a word that we know in our context that is suddenly very, very triggering to somebody else.
It's been interesting now because we're, you know, with Apple TV Plus bringing the show to 100 different countries around the world, and with the show going around the world, we started to work on translations of the text that we did. And obviously, there's a lot of different languages in the show. As we go worldwide, we start to realize that our, you know, the German translation we had needed a little bit of tweaking and everything. But we're actually translating the concepts that we're talking about, right. You know, whether they're tiny little verbatim text or whether it's a whole of how do we come together or what does an islander mean or things like that. And it's been surprising digging into the weeds on that to find how different we really do communicate and how it is not a direct translation. And I think what that speaks to is just how much work it can take, but also the story tells us that it is actually possible to overcome these things. But we have to assume that it isn't easy, that we go into this with the assumption that this might take some work, but it will be so worth it. It's like the prayer that Irene mentioned, that peace was so hard to make all the world religions, you know, prayers from the world religions harmonize together. And it took a lot of work by us and our incredible music team. And at the end, I think it's something really beautiful, but wow, it was a lot more work than we expected. But I think the same thing speaks to how do we communicate with one another and how do we find those commonalities.
Well, also, I guess just because something's easy doesn't make it right, you know? I mean, just because something's hard doesn't make it wrong, you know? Like, in order to be good or kind or correct, it may actually take some work. You know, I think we're fed a lot of the time, like, oh, it's easy. You can do this and you can do that and you can clean your floor in 2 seconds and everything is easy and then that means everything's good, you know? And that just, I think, is not the case.
Mm. Well, along those lines, I appreciate the way the story deals with healing also and the reality that some wounds don't fully heal. I'm thinking about the song, Something's Missing. Can you tell me about that number and what it's trying to say? It feels almost like it has double meaning at this point as we come out of this ongoing pandemic and try to get our lives back together. Can you just talk about that song?
It originally came from the feeling of returning from one world to the other. So many of the people that we talked to when they were in Newfoundland really thought that they had found heaven on earth and they were returning to a really broken world that had lost some innocence, that had lost something. You know, our experience, we were just talking about this, we were looking through photos from 20 years ago, and, you know, you could look down 8th, right, Irene?
Oh, yeah. You can look down 8th Avenue, and, you know, and in 2001, when we lived there, 1999, you know, I'd look down 8th Avenue, and I'd be like, oh, there's the towers, that means I'm going downtown, because I'm directionally challenged. And now, you know, I look down 8th and I see the Come From Away banner. And I'm like, oh, okay, that banner is there because those towers are not, you know, and it's just, and nothing's going to change that. Nothing's going to make it better. Like, really, like, you know, there's something I saw somewhere on some psychological Facebook thing about, like, you know, your grief is like a hole, and at first it's like this, and it takes up everything in your little box here. But then somehow, you know, it can get smaller, and you can live around it. But it can go to here again, you know, like it, and that's just the way it is. You can't like closure and make it go away. You know, it's always there.
And today, more than ever, I mean, so much is missing that we're trying to claw back, that we're trying to open our theaters, that we're trying to reunite with each other. And every time we feel like the vaccines come out and everything is okay, the Delta variant comes out. And so it's really hard right now. There is something missing in all of us, and we are trying to fill it. And we fill it with, you know, with shows on Apple TV Plus. We fill it with content. We fill it with Zoom calls with each other. And it's not quite the same. And therefore, there's something a little bit lacking. And so I think it's important to recognize that grief, to recognize that we are not back to normal yet. And I hope we can be at some point, but we're always going to be changed by this right now in the same way that in 2001, we all changed.
Before I let you go, I do have to ask, though, you know, you're going back to the theater. The show is coming back to Broadway. We're all going. I have yet to go to my first show, but I cannot wait to get back inside a theater. What's it like?
It's amazing. Scary.
It's exciting. It's amazing.
When we recorded the live capture, that was the first time we had been back in a theater. It was a small audience because of the pandemic, but the noise that audience made was amazing. It blew the roof off it. We all wanted to be back. We all wanted to be in a place where we could come together. There's that study that's out there that says our heartbeats start to synchronize with the people next to us. And in the room, we all start to synchronize together. And I think we are hungry for that feeling of coming together. And Broadway is back. Shows are thriving right now. And we can't wait for our show to return on the 21st. It reminds me of when in over 9/11, when our friends in this international residence that we were in came to get us, said, come downstairs. They played music for us. We had a friend who was a pianist, and we all gathered around, and that music helped us come together as a community. That art helped us come together as a community and heal and make our path through this.
Yeah, you know, and also something's missing, right? Like, I couldn't be there. Like, the pandemic is a very real thing. Mm-hmm. Our daughter did not want to be left alone or left with anyone else. She wanted one of her parents. And one of us had to stay home. Like, what, we couldn't both come to the live capture. So it's a new, different world. Like, the people we were before this whole thing happened, you know, we're not the same, you know, and we have to kind of keep the most essential parts of us and go forward.
Irene and David, I really appreciate your time, and I really appreciate this show you made. Thanks for coming on to talk about it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
David Hein and Irene Sinkoff are the creators of the Tony Award-winning Broadway musical Come From Away. Apple TV Plus released a live version of the show this weekend, and it returns to the Broadway stage on September 21st. The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Mixing by Jared Paul. Kevin Bristow and Milton Ruiz were at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Regina Dehir, Karen Frillman, and Kusha Navidar. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Vera Lynn Williams is our executive producer, and I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright or shoot me an email at anxiety@wnyc.org. And of course, I hope you'll join us for the live show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. Stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Until then, thanks for listening. Take care of yourselves.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.